In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 365. Today we're joined by Adam Vasgal, who is the author of the forthcoming book, Generational Poverty, An Economic Look at the Culture of the Poor. Adam teaches economics at Belmont University, and he's been in the financial services industry for 12 years. Show notes page for today is tomwoods.com/365, so check that out. And here we go. I'm talking to Adam Vasgal. Adam, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
I heard about your book because you presented it at the new authors panel at the Austrian Economics Research Conference this year that I was unable to attend, but I looked at the proceedings, I looked through the different paper titles, I got some good feedback about your presentation, about your book, Generational Poverty, from an attendee who said, you got to get this guy on. So I do what I'm told 1 out of 10 times. And so,
right. Yeah.
So here you are. Generational poverty is based on, in large part, on your own observations, supplemented by your knowledge of the social science and economic literature. But it really is based on your observations as part of the Big Brother, Big Sister program in Tennessee where you live. So give us the background then to this.
That's correct. So I joined the Big Brothers, Big Sisters program, which is a mentoring program for at-risk youth. It's basically where parents will sign up their children where they feel like they would benefit from working with someone that has more of a professional background. And in addition to the Big Brothers program, they have sort of a subset program called the Amachi program, which is for children that have an incarcerated parent. So I signed up about a decade ago to work with a young man in this situation, and never intended to write a book about it. But I think the way that economists are typically wired, we sort of see economic data as we observe life, and that certainly happened with my experience with him. And so many things really stood out about his life and lifestyle that it became overwhelming at one point, and I just decided I had to write about it.
And what you're doing then is drawing conclusions based on what you've seen in this particular case, because what you observed is obviously not an isolated incident. It's part of a whole culture. It's part of a whole string of behaviors. It's something that a lot of Americans really don't see up close, because most Americans don't join these programs. Most Americans observe these problems and issues from afar. So you're taking this and spinning out some conclusions. Let's begin by having you tell us about, did you use real names in the book?
I did not, no.
Okay, I suddenly realized I'm not sure I should say, but then of course it is in a book, so I guess I can say. All right, well then, start up by telling us about the 12-year-old boy you were paired with, your so-called little, big brother, little brother thing, and that's Jermaine. That's the name used in the book. Tell us about him, your first impressions of him, of his surroundings, everything you saw.
Okay, well, it was, honestly, it was immediate to observe the difference in culture and the difference in lifestyle that he had when compared to maybe the way that I was raised or the way that I live and people that I know in my community live. And even when I first met him, I went to his house, I talked to his mother, and I immediately, talking to them, they asked, there was kind of not a social worker, but I guess the equivalent with this organization asked her if she had any questions for me, any concerns. And I thought this might be very thorough because of my experience, where if my mother were to let me go out somewhere with a stranger, she would have plenty of questions. The question that his mother had was, Well, I would prefer that you not expose him to any adult material. So for me, as a 25-year-old, completely blushing at the time, the big concern with his mother was that I don't expose him to pornographic materials. And I was like, oh my goodness.
I'm pretty sure they throw you out of the program if you do that.
Yeah.
It'd be like the last thing in the world you would think to do.
That was my thought exactly. I was like, well, if that is her big concern, then I think I should be a positive influence on this young man. But yeah, right out of the gate. So, and I noticed it in a lot of different ways. Even when I decided to write the book, I asked him if it would be okay to interview his family, and basically bribed them with lunch one day and brought it over. And as I walked in the house, I noticed that the eye of the stove was on, and it was, glowing red. And I thought, well, maybe they forgot I was bringing lunch. And then later on, I figured out that they were using the oven and the stove to heat the home. And the peculiar part about that, as if it doesn't sound odd enough, is that there were toddlers and children running around the house. Just completely unsafe. And so I asked I have a friend that's a policeman in that area, and he said that, yeah, that's very common because of the way that gas is subsidized versus electricity. So you see a lot of space heaters, you see a lot of people using their stoves and ovens that are electric to heat the home. So something that I would find totally unacceptable and dangerous was just a common practice.
So what was his life like in the sense of what were his influences, what were the influences of his peers, what were the challenges that you saw him facing, what were the challenges that you saw him facing that, let's say, a kid in your neighborhood wouldn't have faced?
Yeah, that was the part of the relationship that I wasn't ready for, and I wish that I had known that up front. And hopefully my book helps with people that find themselves in a similar situation for a mentoring program. But with him, it's a total battle against the culture that has formed in his society. And one a way that I phrase this in my book is I compare it to Uncle Tom, and I call it basically Uncle Tom syndrome. And it goes back to the character Uncle Tom and how he was a noble character. He was a slave that was considered a good slave. He worked hard. But when a couple of other slaves escaped, he would not give away information that would lead to their capture and was killed. So while that's a noble character, through the years, that started to evolve into a different character. And from my research, I think that basically happened when we started to adapt that story for stage. So to make it appeal to a more white audience, we basically made Uncle Tom into an imbecile that would do whatever he was told, even to the detriment of to himself and the other slaves. And of course, in that version of him, he gives away the location and the information needed to capture the runaway slaves. So this seems to be the character that has resonated over time. And I found that there is a counterculture that has developed within the poor community that very much relates to this idea of, well, I don't want to be an Uncle Tom. I don't want to be a sellout. And it's developed some ideas about attitudes and a way to handle your life that make it very difficult to be successful. And for example, I think when it comes down to the way that school is taught, is learned, is facilitated by teachers and supported by parents, it's really optional. It's not that big a deal to do well in school. Work is frowned upon in many ways. Starting at the bottom, doing work that you feel is beneath you, it's really easy to quit early. I found it when it comes to authority figures. In my upbringing, I felt that my parents knew what was best, and they were going to guide me on that correct path. And the same with my teachers. And I feel like there's in his society, it's a little bit different, where there's a mistrust with a lot of authority figures, and especially with police officers and teachers, and even maybe in the church. So I started to notice these relationships were very different than what I was used to, and it has created this culture that has made it very difficult to find frequency when it comes to success or even just climbing a rung or two on the socioeconomic ladder.
What did you learn in talking to family members? You have in the first part of your book is really a series of backgrounders and interviews with not only this boy, but also members of the family. Then second part involves cultural questions. Third part involves generational mistakes and so on. What else do we learn from talking to other members of the family?
His family is fascinating. They're all very different. I mean, he has a twin brother that has had all kinds of run-ins with authority and the law in general. His first arrest, I will never forget, was when he held up a pizza place at gunpoint because he was hungry. And then he's had multiple arrests since this time. Even when I wanted to interview him, he was battling a rape charge. So lots of issues for this young man. The sister, she just had her fourth kid. She had three when she was a teenager. Again, you know, that's a cultural thing that happens very often. You have children being born very frequently and at a young age, and that makes it very difficult as well. So she's battling with that. And then the young man I work with has Crohn's disease, and so for him, I felt like that was going to be difficult for him to move past because he got disability for that issue. And so when I've suggested for him to find jobs or sent him links to different jobs that I saw pop up in the area, he was really hesitant to look at them because of the idea that it might jeopardize his disability payments.
Now, isn't that funny? We're told constantly that this has no bearing on people's decision-making regarding employment, that it's just a crazy right-wing myth that the welfare state could in any way affect people's decision-making. And yet, of course, we all know that's not true. We all know people who have made many decisions on the basis of the welfare state. What about Jermaine himself? You interviewed him for this, and at the end of, you know, at least your initial interaction with him, to the point where you decided you wanted to write this book, you were asking about future employment, probably to try to see what his ambitions were. What did you find out?
It was disappointing. And, you know, honestly, for me, I think that was some of the motivation for the book was really my failure with him. And he's fallen into a rut where he not only has welfare and disability to support him financially, but he is a fairly responsible young man. And I know that sounds contradictory to some extent, but he is responsible to the point where he is trusted with his mother's children, his sister's children. There's aunts and uncles that are in and out of prison or have drug issues, and he watches their kids. And so, I mean, he has really become the backbone of the family and has to stay home and watch these children. And it's heartbreaking. It really is, because I feel like the longer he takes care of these children, the longer he's out of the workforce, the more complacent he's going to be with that situation, when he's certainly capable of much more.
Let's actually go on ahead to part three of your book, if we may. And here you're trying to draw some overall conclusions. I mean, obviously not based on the one story, but informed by your personal experiences, and then coupling that with what the social science literature has found. Well, first of all, from the point of view of state involvement, because that is what is of primary interest to my listeners, what are the messages, what are the incentives, what are the problems, lasting problems, that it's hard for you as a volunteer to overcome that various state programs are introducing into this equation?
Okay, yeah, it's I would say when it comes to the way that the state does pay people in poverty, it does facilitate a cultural change where we've started to unwind part of the community into a dependence situation. And it's interesting when you do work with the poor, and I feel like that's an important part of this, is that you really do have to work with them and speak with them directly to get an idea of how this works. But my feeling is that they do become dependent on it. And it not only becomes a dependence, but it's more of a way of life, and they learn how to work the system. They learn what to do. I was even told by the young man I worked with that his sister had her third child because it would enable her to get her own place. And this type of thinking is so different than what I'm used to or accustomed to, but it's not that odd for that community. I mean, it's more common than you might think, and it is a way to live, but it's predicated on that idea that that the government and working the government systems is the way that you're going to survive.
Chapter 15 begins with the words, "When I heard about the shooting..." So, situate us there.
Okay.
What shooting are we talking about? And then I want to talk about gangs.
Okay, so sure. So, Nashville has some gangs. I didn't really realize that, but my first real introduction to the gangs in Nashville were from working with this young man. And his mother dated a known gang member who went to prison. And when he went to prison, she decided that she would drive his car around while he was incarcerated. So this car was known, I guess, as a gang affiliated car. And one day while she was driving around, a rival gang in the area just opened fire on the car. So the young man I work with was not in the car, but his twin brother was, and a couple of infants were in the car as well. Luckily, neither of the infants was hit. The mother was hit once. She recovered, and the brother was hit three times, and he also miraculously recovered. But when he told me that story, I was shocked and infuriated at the same time. I just could not believe how irresponsible somebody could be. Apparently there are significant gangs in the area, and his mother had just made a horrible decision to drive this car around.
You've done some reading on the general subject of gangs, and there are different explanations in the social science literature why gangs appear. They appear in some places and not in others. What are the traditional explanations that are given for this?
It's a way from what I looked at, and I really enjoy the sociology side of economics, and it certainly rears its head here. But it's interesting when you start to really study gangs. I think a lot of what attracts people to gangs is that structure and discipline they've not had while they were growing up. And because when you join a gang, I mean, you fall into line. I mean, you are expected to do certain things. There's a very military type of aspect to it, where you're expected to behave a certain way and do certain things, and many of those things, of course, are illegal. But it still provides a structure that's missing in a lot of people's lives. And so, if you feel like you don't have that structure at home, if you feel like you're powerless to your surroundings, a lot of times the gangs provide, in a bit of a perverse way, of course, the things that a lot of those people crave.
So what conclusions can be drawn then with regard to what can be done about poverty, not just about poverty, not just about material poverty? Because I don't think this is entirely a question of material poverty. There are decisions being made here and pressures that are being put on people that are just deranged, that have nothing to do with how much stuff you have. It just has to do with how much common sense and that you have. And there are plenty of poor people who have had a lot of common sense over the years. There are plenty of poor people who have given rise to tremendous entrepreneurial achievements and so on. But how do you've got this culture of poverty, generational poverty, as you call it. How can you possibly crack through it? There may not be anything government can do about people who think in this way.
Yeah, I agree. I think for me, I mean, from an economic standpoint, it was really hard for me to feel comfortable that, well, I'm paying taxes and taxes go to poor people. So in that sort of way, I am helping with the poor situation, when in fact, I feel like it's quite the opposite, where we're creating an enabling type of atmosphere that's only growing the poor population. And if you look at the numbers, there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, the math doesn't lie. So how do you fix it? And it's such a difficult problem to address. But I do feel that there are some ways that you can make a difference. I mean, I think that, in my research, I found that the difference in the frequency of moving up the socioeconomic ladder from a poor community that is surrounded by other wealthy people is much, much higher than if you're in a poor community surrounded by other very poor people. So so there is some help with this just being in the United States in general. Secondly, it gets much more difficult because you really do have to try to influence the culture in some way to change. So, I mean, we have to somehow find a way for the local community leaders. And a lot of times this is going to be parents, teachers, the church. I mean, these folks are going to have to try to change the culture of what is and is not acceptable. And that is incredibly difficult to do. And then the third thing, you know, I mean, I think, you know, as if you do have that idea or that drive where you do want to help with the poor community, I don't think that you can just rely on throwing money at the problem and then feel good about yourself, because it's not really making much of a difference, you know. And so you do have to get involved, and you do have to roll your sleeves up and actually work one-on-one in the community. And that's something a lot of people don't want to admit or even do. But I do feel like that exposure to someone who has a different mindset on how your life should be conducted is important.
It doesn't help that people who claim to be spokesmen for the black community will be people of the Jesse Jackson sort, who I recall an incident some years ago where there was a school and they had expelled some black students for just appalling violent behavior. And Jesse Jackson shows up not to sternly lecture these kids for being a disgrace, but to the contrary, he shows up to try to get them reinstated. So the message is, don't strive for excellence. I mean, nobody's even remotely calling on you to strive for excellence. It's not even remotely expected that you would strive for excellence. Instead, when you get in trouble, we'll make a lot of noise and try and clean up your mess. I mean, if that were the message I were getting 24 hours a day, maybe that would affect my behavior too.
Yeah, I have a chapter where I write about school in general and how teachers are treated, and it's funny. I've already mentioned this my friend who's a police officer. He was actually a teacher. He was an English major in college and got his master's and taught in a school where a child in his class, and this is high school, so I think he was a freshman, took a swing. I mean, tried to punch him in class. And so he told him to leave the classroom and then went into the hall where he was attacked again. And my friend's a pretty big guy, and he basically pinned the student to the wall and asked another student to go get the principal. And you fast forward a couple of weeks, and my friend's getting fired for assaulting a student. And he just asked the principal, you know, well, how do I handle a situation where a student is attacking me? I mean, do I just let him punch me until he gets tired, or how, you know, how, what do I do? And they just said, you know, you just have to back away, and then eventually the student will figure out that what they're doing is wrong. And he's like, well, I guess teaching is not going to be my career because I can't live with that. So it's the deterioration of our schools from that perspective. I mean, it takes a really tough, unique individual to teach. And because of that, you're finding many, many quality teachers that are looking for other occupations.
Before I let you go, what exactly is generational about this generational poverty? What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that it grows on itself, poverty, that is. And keep in mind, this is not just the African-American poor community. I mean, this is across, from my research, poor communities of all demographics. And everything that we learn, especially at an early age, comes from our parents and our family and our church and our teachers. And as the culture changes and as generations fly by, the things that we hand down are going to be the things that we learn and the way that our society is going to progress. And so from a generational perspective, we're seeing this unwinding of people from a cultural perspective where they don't know how to be successful. I mean, they literally do not know how to do it. And as the culture continues to devolve, I guess, you know, going in the a different direction than what we learn and what we support as areas to be successful. It's a really troubling trend. And so the generational nature of that is really my focus, because as it continues to trend that direction, as it continues to unwind, poverty can become a much, much bigger issue than it is now.
I'm talking to you on March 24th, 2015, and as of today, your book is awaiting release. There is a pre-order page on Amazon. We're going to link to that on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/365. It may say out of stock, but that's just Amazon sometimes is clueless about what's really happening. What it really should say is available for pre-order, so you can just go ahead and click on it, and you'll get it. So the book is Generational Poverty, An Economic Look at the Culture of the Poor. Linked at tomwoods.com/365 for your convenience, along with your Twitter and whatever else I can think to put up there. Adam, thanks so much for your time today. Best of luck with the book.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you so much, Tom.
All right, don't forget the show notes page, tomwoods.com/365. And while you're there, look up at the top of the screen. You'll see a way to sign up to get a free ebook. That ebook is called 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered, and it's full of great stuff, and it'll help you when you are put upon by all your non-libertarian friends. So check that out, tomwoods.com/365, show notes page for today. You'll also find that offer really on any page at tomwoods.com. And of course, I also have a brand new book, like an actual print book that you can hold in your hands, which also does have a Kindle edition and an audiobook version, and that, of course, is Real Dissent. If you like this show, and in particular, I know we have a lot of people who like the episodes where we take an article and we just let that article have it. We just go up one side of it and down the other, then you are really going to like Real Dissent, because it brings together a lot of examples of your host here doing precisely that. So you'll enjoy it, I think, and you'll get some ammunition that you yourself can use. So that book is Real Dissent. You can check it out at a special site I set up for it, realdissent.com. And you can get the audiobook with me reading it for free via the offer at tomwoodsaudio.com. Make sure you subscribe to the show on iTunes or Stitcher so you don't miss a single episode, because we're producing another one tomorrow. We'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.